Welcome back, my future swellies, to season 4 of Sustainability in the Sea, a podcast produced by Future Swell, hosted by me, your host, Carissa Cabrera. You might hear some rain in the background right now, and that's because we're in the middle of the Blue Mind Challenge that I do every January where I spend time with the ocean. And obviously the earth knows that, which is why it is downpouring while I am producing the intro of this episode. So we're just going to celebrate the fact that our podcast is so supported by the earth that they wanted to give us background noise during this introduction. Okay. All right. How's everyone doing today? This is season 4. We've been at Sustainability in the Sea for over 2 years now. We've put out so many episodes focused on ocean climate solutions, focusing on marine biology advice. And if you're a new listener this year, I just wanted to formally welcome you to the show. We post across all places you listen to podcasts and also YouTube, and we commit to be 90% video. So we're kicking off this season with a guest and a brand that Future Swell has been familiar with for quite some time now. 12 Tides is a kelp chip brand that has been growing tremendously in recent years, partially because their chips are delicious and also because their social media game is fire. Shout out Emmy. But mostly because they're a regenerative ocean climate solution and they have tapped into a market and a consumer demand that is really needed. We sit down with the co-founder, Pat, during this episode to talk about how he built 12 Tides as a co-founder. He went from working in industrial commercial fishing vessels and seeing up close and personal how harmful this industry is to the ocean to building a regenerative ocean brand rooted in kelp chips. If you have never heard of kelp forests before, I'm just going to give you a really quick summary of all of the ways that they are an extremely high potential climate solution. Kelp forests support a ton of different biodiversity. If you've ever gone diving in a kelp forest, you're sure to see over 10 different species. They're called biodiversity hotspots. And because kelp forests are big and tall, all different parts of the kelp support habitat and structure for ecosystems. They also grow really quickly. They only need sunlight and space to grow. And while they're growing, they're sucking in carbon dioxide, which means that they're a buffer to increasing emissions and a source of blue carbon, which we need more of. Third, they actually protect coastal communities in two different ways through resilience. They actually dissipate wave energy. So if there's like extreme weather or a storm and there's a kelp forest buffering the coastline, then the coastal community is less likely to experience the peak of severity if the kelp forest wasn't there. So they absorb the shock energy of waves coming up. And the second is that they support community jobs for folks who live on coastlines. So blue economies are the words that we use to describe the jobs, livelihoods, and economic potential of areas on coastlines. Coastal communities are frontline communities in the climate crisis, and they need good paying, sustainable jobs taking care of their ocean. And being a kelp farmer or a regenerative ocean farmer, so that could be like oysters too, is a huge potential pathway when we look at diversifying the economy in a way that helps the planet. All of these reasons are why we are obsessed with kelp forests at Future Swell, and it's also why we've been a huge supporter of 12 Tides. One of the reasons we timed this episode up the way we did is because it coincides with their incredible milestone achievement of being accessible in Whole Foods nationwide in the US, which means that you can literally put on this episode and by the end of the episode have gone to Whole Foods and supported this company by buying delicious kelp chips and supporting the ocean no matter where you live. So whatever place you are tuning into right now, you can be a part of supporting regenerative ocean farming solutions because of this milestone partnership. And for a small business like this, I couldn't be more excited for them. And I think that the best is yet to come. You're gonna learn a lot from Pat. If you ever wanted to be an entrepreneur, if you've ever wanted to pivot your career, and if you want some words of wisdom and advice from someone who has been through the ringer and building this business for the last handful of years, this is an episode for you. Send it to someone you love. Please give us a review. I have never really asked you guys to do this, and I'm realizing how important they are. So please give us a review, and welcome back, you guys. It's season four of Sustainability and the Scene. To Sustainability in the Sea.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Where are you tuning in from?
San Francisco.
So I think I learned about 12 Tides because you guys have had truly like a really good social media game for years now. Has that always been something that you prioritized?
It's something that's important for us because there's a lot of education that goes along with our mission. Mm-hmm. And we use social media as a platform to bring people into the mission that we have around regenerative ocean foods. Mm-hmm. But also to educate, I think, a good chunk of the American population about the benefits of kelp and why kelp is amazing, as both a part of the ocean, but also as a food source. And it's not something that, most people are super familiar with.
Yeah, I think you do a really great job on there of like teaching people new things. So, okay, let's take it back to the origin. So where did you grow up, and were you always a kelp fan, or did you end up feeling connected to the ocean when you were really young or later in life? I always like to ask everyone's origin stories because it really like lays the platform for how they dedicated their lives to something related to ocean conservation.
Yeah, so actually started a little bit further away from oceans. I grew up in Minnesota, but my mom worked in conservation for her entire career, and my sister works for the National Marine Fisheries Service in DC. So I always had some of that sort of exposure. I was fortunate enough to start scuba diving when I was 13, when I got my first certification. And since then I've been lucky enough to do it all over the world. And after graduating undergrad, I went into sort of food and agriculture for its intimate, tie-in with the environment, and quickly got sucked into the seafood world, partly due to what I learned from my sister and my mom, but partly because it is a part of the food system that is so opaque and I thought was very interesting in its opacity. That when you crack the hood open, in large part, the uglier it gets. And so after seeing and being a part of that for almost 10 years, I wanted to dedicate my career to transforming the ocean food system to something that could be considered regenerative. Mm.
We have had a handful of folks that work in international fisheries on the podcast, and one of them focused specifically on the human rights lens of it. And mm-hmm. I think it really like cracked open the reality of what it's like to work on those vessels as women, as migrants. And I think that I'm grateful that stories are starting to be told about this industry so that there'll be more push to transform it. I think it's a big lift, and I really applaud the people working on the front lines of that, because the industry is so important. It's not going anywhere, right? And we need to implement small solutions. So I appreciate that that's part of your story. When you said that you started scuba diving at such a young age, what was the first ecosystem you dove? Do you remember?
Yeah, so I got that first. So first of all, I was on a trip with my family in Grand Cayman is where it was. And we had gone out snorkeling, and some of us were going to go out snorkeling, and now my older sister was going to go scuba diving because she was old enough to scuba dive, and I was a bit of a stubborn child, and so when I found out that my sister would get to scuba dive and I had to snorkel, I was like, no, you put me underwater or I will die trying here on this boat. And so they, agree to let me do it, even though I think that you're kind of below the generally permitted age at
Yeah,
13.
right at the cusp.
But from the first time doing that, just being immersed in the ecosystem, I thought was just, so fascinating and such a unique and sort of, majestic experience under the water that I quickly got sucked in and have now, logged close to 300 dives on six continents. So
I
been a
just dove the Coral Triangle earlier this month for the first time, and I felt like I had never seen a healthy reef until then. It's such a, I
You
think
don't
scuba,
see very many these days anymore.
I know, especially where I am in Hawaii, we just we've got restoration, but it doesn't grow as fast. And so the re I was working with some organizations in Indonesia that do coral restoration, and they just have such fast growing corals, they can just grow these entire gardens like over the course of a couple of years. But it definitely gave me a lot of hope being there. And I think that the scuba dive industry is such a great conservation entry point potential for conservationists to actually get into this field. So I appreciate that your origin story starts there. So why kelp? You're in this, you're working in the seafood industry, you're 10 years in, and you're like, I want to be part of solutions. Did something happen where you realized that that solution pathway was going to be kelp?
Yeah, so in seafood, I did all sorts of things, and in every part of the world, I worked on 100-meter factory trawlers to scallop harvesting, net pen fish farming, shrimp farming, et cetera, and saw all of those industries had some pretty negative components to them, and so I saw sort of two things that I could do with my career. Number one was make all of those things like a little bit less bad. Probably never going to be an active good over there, but you can make them less bad.
Less bad.
I can, try to find and support things that we can grow in the ocean that really do an active good. And there's a couple of things that fall into that category, but one thing that I thought was particularly interesting was kelp. I think just given its potential to transform the seafood ecosystem in the United States, the opportunity for coastal communities to generate new income streams, and it was at a point at the time where I felt like that's where my skill set of creating high value end markets for kelp would make sort of a transformational difference for the industry.
Yeah, it's low cost of entry too, right? For farmers. Like it's relatively because it's fast growing and doesn't require so many additives, it's actually a relatively simple crop to grow. Is that true?
Sometimes I think the simplicity of it is like a little overblown in
Yeah.
media. Number one, our farmers are incredibly smart and talented. And part of the reason I went into kelp products is because I knew I couldn't do that. I knew I couldn't be a farmer. I didn't have the technical knowledge that's really required to create and start a successful kelp farm. The capital requirements are not, I wouldn't say they're low, because you still need like a harvesting
Space.
vessel, and the permitting timeline itself is pretty long and somewhat capital intensive, and all of our farmers have processing assets to some degree, so it does require an investment to get started as well, and I know all of our farmers have invested heavily in that, so I don't want that to be sort of lost. But I think hopefully as the industry scales, I think my hope for the future would be that in that first year of farming, we have a good enough understanding of the biology and the life cycle of kelp, and the marine ecosystems in which it's being grown, as well as the infrastructure around it from sort of nursery to processing, that a farmer could be profitable in their first year or their second year. And I think that's probably generally not the case right now, but that would be the hope for the future.
Mm-hmm. Aquaculture as a whole is a growing sector, right? Particularly in California. And I think we see it with kelp as well. Can you share a little bit about the 12 tides framework? I know you work with many farmers, and kind of how you develop this framework, if it was, you know, beta testing over the course of the initial years.
Yeah. So we source from farms in Maine and Alaska. Mm-hmm. And those are the two states right now. It's state by state regulations. You're always farming in state waters. So those two states, I think, because those are the states that are most heavily reliant on declining legacy seafood industries, are the states that have been sort of at the forefront of kelp farming and creating this new economic opportunity for coastal communities. California, I would say, is far behind in sort of the permitting and the, you know, regulatory aspect of it. We don't really have any commercial kelp farms in California right now. I think there's some very small sort of early stage operations, maybe a little bit more academic and in nature, spread out across the state. And there is one operation out in federal waters as well, but doesn't really have a food and markets focus. My hope is eventually, and I think, you know, good results of the development of the industry in Maine and Alaska will go a long way in helping other states take the right steps to supporting this industry.
Yeah. Well, Maine and Alaska too, like nutrient-rich areas, incredibly engaged ocean community, right? And I guess when you established those partnerships, were you working kind of, with your team to figure out, you know, how are we going to process this to make the product like taste good and be, it's got a great shelf life, you know, like I think that part of product design, is that something you had experience with, or were you just kind of learning as you went?
No, I winged it to a certain degree. We started out at the farmers markets in the Bay Area, and it was a great testing ground at that stage of the company to be able to show up every week with maybe a slightly different recipe, a tweaked recipe. Selling the product was great, and it was a signal of whether or not it could be successful. But probably even more important than that was just being able to hand out samples to like 500, 1,000 people over the span of 4 hours and get everybody's reactions to it for, you know, almost zero cost. It was like $50 a week. So that was incredibly, valuable. And then we took the chip concept. We actually started off with a few different products at the farmer's market booth. And then we took the chip concept, iterated on that a few times for more than a few, like for 9 months at the farmer's market. And then eventually we took the final recipe into retail.
Yeah. And now you're in Whole Foods.
And now we're in Whole Foods.
Farmer's market to Whole Foods. That should be the title of this episode. did you imagine, was this the goal?
It's not the goal. I think it's a milestone on the way to a bigger goal, but it is an important one. You know, we've grown from a farmer's market to being sort of locally distributed. I drove to our initial retailers and brought cases in the trunk of my car. And then, we were regional for a while up and down the West Coast, and now we're a national brand. So, that is, I think those are all great milestones, on the way to a much bigger mission, but, we're only partway there.
It's definitely something to celebrate. Make sure you take a moment to celebrate that, because it's a huge one. Our audience, they're early mid-career, they're trying to learn about Ocean Solutions so that they can work directly for them or create their own. They're constantly asking us for advice. Most of them are still finishing up schooling. And I really wanted to ask you, you know, throughout this process of farmers market to Whole Foods, what were like your biggest challenges as a co-founder?
Oh yeah, there's quite a few. I think the challenge that we've wrestled with sort of continuously is you know, what is our core sort of mission and which, you know, pillars do we want to die on? you know, what's maybe, you know, not our mission, and maybe can leave that to somebody else to solve it. And so we do an enormous amount relative to most food brands.
Your packaging in itself.
Yeah, from, you know, the operations and the kelp supply chain, you know, through to the packaging, through to even, you know, field marketing and education and social media, we're doing all that in-house. So number one is we have a really complex kelp supply chain, which we manage, you know, with our farmers, that is very different than any other food brand. You know, most people just buy commodity ingredients from big ingredient suppliers. And then secondly, they send those ingredients to a co-manufacturer and somebody third party makes their product for them. And then maybe they'll hire sort of an external social media firm, an external, like field marketing firm or agency. And for us, none of those things sort of, you know, accomplish what we wanted to accomplish at our core in terms of our mission for the oceans and for the food system. And so I think a couple of things that we've, you know, made sacrifices on where we've kind of chosen, hey, you know, maybe that's, we can't do everything, so we can't do piece of it, but we have taken on a lot ourselves. And so I think balancing that, you know, huge scope of work that a lot of food products and consumer brands, you know, don't have is, and scaling all of that up together, you know, step for step, that's probably our biggest challenge.
Yeah. I had no idea that that's how most food products were created. Like, it makes sense that it's outsourced, but I also then conceptualizing that you guys don't, seems like I'm even more grateful for you taking time out of your day now to talk with us and share about the process. What about the flavors? What flavors do you offer now? And are you trying to add more to the library?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we got 5 flavors now. You know, sea salt, everything, chili, were the original 3. The 2 new ones are truffle and pepper and vegan cheddar. And I think we've got 5 great flavors, you know, right now. We're looking at maybe doing some like limited time flavors or seasonal flavors here and there. We'll probably keep the core at 5. We're looking at opportunities to do collaborations with other brands on those flavor profiles as well. We're pretty focused on pushing out our existing SKU assortment right now before we get, you know, too crazy on SKUs.
Well, I'm glad you added vegan cheddar because that one's for sure my favorite. So thank you for that. And then my partner likes the chile one, the spicy one. So, yeah. I did want to ask you about the packaging. So it's compostable. You guys are also a B Corp, right? So that process of getting to this level of packaging for something that has such a long shelf life and can be held in the pantry, you know, how did you decide on what you have? And maybe for those listening that might not know or aren't familiar with 12 Tides, can you give us a little bit of a rundown of what the packaging is as well?
Yeah, so I think that that goes back to our last discussion about like which battles do we want to fight? And I think
we can't have a million missions.
Yeah. We can't do all things, but, you know, being a net positive brand for the oceans and having single use, your typical single use petroleum-based plastics was a hard thing to reconcile. And so we set out on this mission to find an alternative packaging format that would be, you know, better than single-use petroleum-based plastics. And so we worked with a Japanese material supplier to basically design this laminate structure out of, you know, largely wood pulp based material. It is industrially compostable right now. And the vast majority of the materials are home compostable with the exception of the zipper. And so we're looking at, you know, generating a home compostable version in the near future, to give everybody the, you know, the opportunity at least to realize what we believe is the best end case for packaging, which would be sort of returning to the earth in a safe and productive manner. We recognize that, so that's the part that we did do. The part that we didn't do was, you know, recognizing that almost nobody has access to industrial composting facilities, and almost nobody in the United States, you know, realistically composts at home. There's a development of the ecosystem that needs to happen to realize, I think, the best you know, end case for this packaging. And until that happens, our packaging probably doesn't have a dramatically positive impact. But, you know, we, so that's kind of the, you know, what we chose to sort of bite off versus, you know, composting infrastructure in the United States. We decided was, we want to support other people who are on that mission, yeah, but it's probably something that we're not going to be able to do. But our perspective on the matter was this: like, we know what doesn't work for the ocean, and that is single-use petroleum-based plastics. And so we need to come up with something else. And we want to encourage consumers to start thinking and prioritizing alternatives to that single-use petroleum-based plastics. And in particular, you know, we are a small brand with almost no resources, and we were able to come up with something that is, you know, more sustainable than what all the big brands are using. And so people should be asking the big brands, like, why are you not doing this? Yeah. And they're making a pretty pointed, you know, effort or case that they are, have chosen to not pursue any sort of, you know, sustainable alternatives. And I think people should be asking why.
Yeah. Well, that's what I love about bringing the solutions on this podcast, is that the idea is that people can look to you and be like, this is a social media strategy that should be employed by product brands. This is the type of packaging that we can do. And this is the type of supply chain that we can, you know, at least consider implementing so that it's, you know, more mindful of our workers and all of these things. Like, you can serve as a, not just what 12 Tides does in its impact in its time on the world, but also like as a legacy brand for ways, for an example for people to look to, with the Whole Foods brand. So you're now available in US Whole Foods across the nation. Yeah. People can turn off this episode and go get 12 Tides as a snack. And I think that that's not just huge in so many ways and speaks to so much work that was put in for many years, but also it sounds like just the beginning for you guys. What's ahead for 12 Tides?
Yeah. And, you know, ultimately we want to be nationwide. Ultimately we want to be international.
Everywhere.
But in the big picture, you know, for our current price, especially, we're replacing, industrial farmed corn to, I think, a pretty good extent. And right now we eat about 35 pounds of corn per person per year in the United States. And, you know, one of our thought exercises is, and this will happen through products more than just our own. You know, people eat things that are not chips quite frequently, but, you know, if we can introduce kelp as an ingredient and an ingredient that people want to incorporate into their diets, can we make that 30 pounds of corn and 5 pounds of kelp? And the impact that that would have on marine ecosystems, on emissions of the food system in general, Kelp has about 10% of the carbon footprint of industrial farm corn in the United States. That would be dramatic. And you know, that is, we need to be at sort of a nationwide level to eventually make that happen. And other kelp products will need to be at a nationwide level as well. But it's a really important step on the way to that mission.
So people listening can support reducing emissions by just eating more kelp.
Yeah, I think, and beyond just kelp, I think kelp is one of the best ways to do it. But by, you know, digging into the ingredient profiles of what you eat and prioritizing the things that are grown in the most sustainable fashion, there are other lower emissions alternatives to a lot of things that we eat in the U.S. And I think that some of those small changes can really add up.
Great. Well, that's very clear. And also you're making it taste really good. So it's not that hard of a lift. Do you have any advice to people listening that might want to be working in, see themselves working in ocean conservation as the field kind of booms, hopefully the way it is during our lifetimes?
Yeah, I think it is booming. And, you know, I think being able to sort of put your values to work like every day in your career is incredibly inspiring. And so whatever you sort of love and believe in, and you know, if that is the ocean, or if you have really amazing memories of yourself in the ocean, it's a hard thing to regret sort of just making the jump and going and finding an amazing you know, ocean-oriented or ocean-centric organization to work for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or starting your own company.
Nobody regrets it that I talk to. So, all right, our last question, we actually ask every single guest the exact same question. It's if you had to put like a message on a billboard that all of the most powerful people in the world would see, what would your billboard say? And, you know, we've had artists come on. Sometimes they were like, yeah, I wouldn't say anything. It would be like this graphic or something. But yeah. Sure. And I mean, all of our most powerful people are kind of all together right now. So if you could put a billboard for them or a message, what would it say?
I think it would say something to do with, especially if it's all the most powerful people and a lot of people who are allocating, you know, resources of the world, should be allocated toward regenerating the oceans. And you know, I think ideally for me, taking that perspective that we can do things that are active positive and really throwing full weight behind you know, those types of things, you know, whether it's, you know, kelp farming or, you know, other types of, you know, net positive mariculture, whether it's, you know, cleaning up, you know, marine ecosystems, you know, whether it's even like some, you know, nature positive, like marine carbon dioxide removal solutions. Like, I think there are some net positive things that, you know, we can and should be supporting in the oceans, and I would like to see a greater prioritization there and more resources dedicated to that space.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time and sharing your vision with us. I think it humanizes the work people see about 12 tides to a different level. So thank you so much for coming on Sustainability in the Sea.